Hello, and welcome to Power Pros Podcast, episode 34, Legend of the Unemployed Ninja. I am one of your co-hosts, the Hoff, Chris Hoffman, and with me is my favorite assist trophy, Chris Slate.
Hello.
We are back to talk about all the happenings in the world of Nintendo, and our big topic this week is going to be our favorite Japanese Nintendo game developers. But before we get into that, we're going to kick it off with some game impressions and some news. And first of all, I'd like to start with Mario & Luigi Paper Jam, which just came out a couple days ago as we're recording this. Christopher Slate, have you played Mario & Luigi Paper Jam yet?
I haven't actually. Unusually, it's taken me a little bit of time to get to this one.
Ah, understandable. Yeah, I actually haven't had a chance to buy the game yet, but I was able to get a hold of a copy and play it for a few hours. And I gotta tell you, I would really like to be able to go buy it because I'm really enjoying it so far. You know, it's what you'd expect. It's Mario and Luigi, and they're teaming up with Paper Mario. So it's got, you know, all of the fun and quirkiness and humor and the unique gameplay elements that Mario and Luigi bring to the table, you know, controlling different characters with different buttons and all the timing-based attacks and so on and so forth. But what worried me when I played it in demo form was that controlling three characters was going to be really problematic. And it's definitely more complex than previous Mario and Luigi games. But the game goes the extra mile to try to help you out with this. It does have an optional indicator you can turn on, so it's easier to tell who's being targeted, and so you're able to react to that quicker. And when you're on the field, there is a button that will let you make all three characters jump simultaneously, so maneuvering becomes much easier. You don't have to hit A, then B, then Y to just jump up a simple hill. You can just hit the X button and everybody does it.
That sounds handy. And how are you enjoying the new run button?
Oh, well, I guess that probably is the run button now that you mention it. The way it works is you hit the X button and everybody like does sort of a flutter jump into the air. They'll hover for a little bit. And then when you come down, you start dashing. And that's really used for solving puzzles, I guess. And, one of the things that happens at the beginning of the game is that all of the paper toads blow out of this book. That's how the game starts. Luigi is helping a toad, and they cause this book to fall, and all the paper characters shoot out of it. Paper Bowser, Paper Mario, paper bad guys, Koopas and Goombas and whatnot, and paper toads. And the bad guys, of course, team up with the other three-dimensional bad guys, and all of the paper toads get sort of hunted down and chased, and they all go into hiding. But you're trying to find them and rescue them. So far in the early goings, I spent a lot of time using this run button to dash after toads and catch them and tackle them, be like, oh, don't worry, you're safe now, and take them back to the castle. And then they actually help you out by developing new powers, I guess.
Mm. Now, both Paper Mario and the Mario & Luigi series have always had a lot of things in common. Mm-hmm. But there are some differences, and they have a slightly different kind of feel to them. Would you say that this definitely feels like a Mario and Luigi game guest starring Paper Mario, or is it the other way around, or exactly how does it come across?
Oh no, it's definitely a Mario and Luigi game guest starring Paper Mario, and even where the villains are involved, you see the two Bowsers meet up, and at first they're like, hey, I'm the real Bowser. No, I'm the real Bowser. And they start fighting and scuffling. But then when they show up to inevitably capture the princesses, because there are two princesses, regular Mario and Luigi Bowser has sort of taken the lead, and Paper Bowser is second fiddle a little bit, I guess. So, you can tell from that perspective, yes, this is clearly Mario and Luigi. This is their world. This is their game. And the other guys are just sort of, putting in guest appearances. But, there's plenty of papery goodness to go around. One of the new aspects of the game are these papercraft battles. And that's one of the parts that, ties into the story of finding the toads, because you need to find a certain number of toads so they can help you with these papercrafts. And what they do is they make a big papercraft Mario that you use to fight other papercraft enemies. And it's all real time, sort of this battle arena type thing, where you have to tackle the other paper craft and then stomp on them. And, you know, then you're like, you know, reassembling your paper craft so you can, you know, get ready for the next attack. And it's a little slow and plodding and kind of weird, but still strangely fun. I do worry that, you know, when I get into the more advanced battles, because this was, you know, just the first one, I played up a little past this first papercraft battle. I'm worried that later on it's going to get a little, you know, wonky, because there are some, you know, some camera issues and things like that. And hopefully it remains fun later in the game. It doesn't get just infuriating. But yeah, from what I've played, everything is a lot of fun. And there's also an optional easy mode if things do get too tough. I did not try that out myself, but I appreciate the fact that they put it in there.
Well, speaking of easy, kind of, you know, this series has taken a little bit of heat, especially the last game, from how tutorial heavy it is right off the bat. Do you feel like it's less lightened up any in that regard, or is it still a lot of, you know, kind of help screens you have to get through before the adventure really gets rolling?
Well, certainly in the part I played, it did feel like there was a lot of stuff that you're learning, but not quite as much as in the previous game. I think they have learned their lesson and they have improved that. You know, they're still in there. It's still got those tutorials. Like I said, I was several hours in and I just got this first papercraft battle. And of course that isn't too hard. It is still, you know, a bit of a teaching experience, but I do think it's improved over the last one for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no getting around it. They have to teach you how to do certain things. But it's nice to hear that maybe they've pulled back as much as they can and that they don't go overboard with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so far I'm really enjoying it. I do recommend it, and I hope I get a chance to purchase it and really sink my teeth into it soon.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a game I'm not going to wait too much longer to play.
Now, unfortunately, here is a game that you will have to wait longer to play. And that is Mighty No. 9, which was supposed to be coming out on Wii U as well as competing systems in February. And they delayed this game a while back because of some of the network features they were going to have, the online co-op. And now they've announced it has been delayed again to some indeterminate time in spring because of network issues. Apparently, they never figured out what the problem was the first time, and they're just delaying the game again.
Yeah, as a backer to their Kickstarter campaign, I got an email, you know, a very apologetic and very detailed email from Ifune himself, or at least mm-hmm. he signed off on it, explaining, you know, in pretty good detail exactly what the issues were. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like we say about every big game delay. It's better to delay it, you know, and get it right than release it, you know, earlier and have it be not that great. But you'd like to think after one very high profile delay already that, they would have been able to really commit to that second release date and apparently not.
Yeah, it was supposed to be out last fall. And, the other thing is that it's really a different issue when you've got you know, backers who've already paid for this thing and have been waiting and waiting and waiting, and you know, it seems like, oh, you know, they aren't able to deliver. I'm sure they will, but it can get pretty frustrating, and I see why it makes people upset.
Well, it just puts a lot more pressure on the team behind the game and on Inafune because you know, the Kickstarter was such a tremendous record-setting success at the time, and he really had you know, all of the goodwill behind him. And that's really, I think you wrote it to some degree at this point. And
yeah, totally.
I'm sure a lot will be forgiven if the game comes out and as good as we're all hoping it will be. But man, that is quite a bit of extra pressure to make sure you deliver after all this. And I got to say, as someone who didn't really care about a Mega Man type game having any kind of online functions to begin with, it's a little frustrating that that's the stuff that's been holding up the release for so long.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's frustrating because, you know, I'm sure there are people out there that have experience making games with online co-op, and, you know, they should probably be able to find them and get their expertise to make this game finally come out. It's been months. How can you not be able to find someone who knows what they're doing in this regard? But yeah, for the people who don't really care about that, I can see it being extra frustrating. Personally, I think it's a really cool feature, and it's one that Mega Man has never done. And so I really understand the desire to be like, hey, we're going to, you know, try out this feature that we were never able to pull off with Mega Man. We're going to do it right here. But yeah, it's disappointing that it's like delayed the game for, you know, like 8 months or whatever it's going to be once the thing finally comes out. So
yeah, well,
it's kind of ridiculous.
I'm not gonna kick Inafune too much while he's down. It is disappointing, but you know, I'm sure you know, it impacts, you know, those guys making the game more than anyone, and I would imagine they're trying their hardest, but unfortunately they just haven't quite gotten the job done yet. But but if it's a good game, like I said, if it's a good game when they finally do get it completed, then that'll be the most important thing in the long run, I guess.
Yeah, I've definitely enjoyed what I played on Xbox One and PlayStation 4 so far, and hopefully the final product lives up to those initial impressions and the high hopes everyone has had.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's another interesting game that is on the way. It's a new Pokemon title called Great Detective Pikachu.
That was quite a surprise.
Yeah, and apparently it is coming out in Japan very soon. Like next week soon, the 3rd of February. And, you know, I guess they have made mention of something, you know, about this game quite a while back. But this is the first time it's really congealed and been, you know, officially announced as what it is. And it is what they're calling a cinematic adventure game. Pikachu talks and wears clothes. And basically he's walking around like Sherlock Holmes. And he like meets a human boy named Tim, who I guess is going to be his sidekick, going to be his Watson. And that's just really, I think, all anybody knows about the game so far. I mean, I read about this, and then I thought later, did I just dream this? This is a really weird thing. This can't be real.
This does sound like it would be one of your dreams, because you play so much Professor Layton and Phoenix Wright and all those kinds of detective-y
it's
games.
It's true.
Now, when you say Pikachu talks, I assume he's not just going, you know, Pika Pika Choo Choo. He's going to be like Elementary My Dear Tim, like.
So it seems, yes.
And as far as I can remember, and I don't have the best Pokemon knowledge, but as far as I can remember, the only time the Pokemon have actually spoken before, not counting, you know, certain characters in the cartoon, was in the Mystery Dungeon series, I think. Is that right?
I couldn't tell you for sure, but yeah, I mean, definitely there was a lot of talking in the Mystery Dungeon games. That was the last one I played, and yeah, they're just, you know, talking back and forth constantly.
Yeah, that was kind of the hook for that game, that you were a Pokemon, so you could actually understand the other Pokemon.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a little bit of a curveball. This is something that they don't usually do, I think.
I mean, there was that what was it called, Hey You Pikachu, way back mm-hmm. in the day
on the N64. But that was where you would use
was that N64? Was it GameCube?
I want to say it was N64, and you used a mic to actually give Pikachu commands, like Pikachu was like an old school Siri or something, and you would try to get Pikachu. It was more like, I guess, a little Tamagotchi style, or not Tamagotchi, Tamagotchi, I think it used to be called, right? Little virtual pet. It was kind of like a little virtual pet thing, but I never got a chance to do too much with it, so I guess I'm not entirely sure, but. But I don't think he really spoke in that. So, and he certainly didn't do any detecting, from what I remember.
Okay. I remember there was a lot of, you know, talking involved. I can't remember if it was him talking to you or just you talking to him. I can confirm that it was a Nintendo 64 game, not a GameCube game.
Aha. My memory's holding up a little bit.
Like a sieve, my friend.
It's like a sieve.
But, yeah, regardless of whether this is, you know, the first time we've had Pokemon talking, or the fifth time we've had Pokemon talking, it's definitely out there. It's definitely weird. It's definitely different. And it is an interesting way to celebrate this year of Pokemon, the 20th Pokemon anniversary.
It's kind of cool thinking about it in those terms, that for the 20th anniversary, the Pokemon company seems to be trying some really interesting experiments. I mean, maybe the most obvious thing that they could have done is come out with the next, you know, full-featured pair of mainline Pokemon RPGs.
Which could still happen.
Yeah, it could still happen. We've got a whole year for those types of announcements. But instead, what we've seen is Pokemon Go on mobile, and we've seen, you know, this game, and we're just getting the sense that they're, we've seen some more recent stuff, even, you know, stuff like Pokemon Picross. You know,
and the classic re-releases, don't forget those.
Yeah. So it seems like there, not only is there a lot of activity already early on in this anniversary year for Pokemon, but a lot of really wild and experimental things. So, you know, if you look back on the fact there's been two decades of Pokemon now, I think it's great that they're trying new things and you know, making sure they keep the brand fresh.
Yeah, it is definitely interesting, if nothing else. So last week on Virtual Console, we saw the release on Wii U in the eShop of Super Mario Advance 4, Super Mario Brothers 3.
That's kind of a confusing title for people that don't know the history, but ultimately it is just a Super Mario Brothers 3 re-release that they put out on the Game Boy Advance back in the day. It had the kind of slight graphical bump to 16-bit style that was originally included in the Super Mario All-Stars cartridge.
Yes, yes it was. Yeah, for some reason they released those games in an awkward order as Super Mario Advance, and it is really confusing. But the point is, it's an enhanced version of Super Mario Brothers 3, originally on GBA, and now it is on Virtual Console. But what's exciting about this is that the original Game Boy Advance title was compatible with the eCard reader, which, you know, was a device you plugged into your Game Boy Advance, and you had to run these physical cards through it, and it would give you extra content.
Yeah, it was like swiping a it was like swiping a debit card or something at the grocery store.
Yeah, I mean, it was like a really clunky precursor to DLC, sort of. You couldn't download it, but you could go buy these cards and swipe them in through this funky device, and it would give you new stuff. And what's cool is that this version of the game, the Virtual Console version, includes all that extra content. There's a whole bunch of brand new levels that a lot of people have probably never played before. There's like remixed classic levels. And so it's got all this newish Mario content there's a good chance you've never seen, because those old cards were really hard to come by. Plus, you'd have to actually own the e-card reader. I think I do own one pack of the cards, but I don't think I even ever opened it up.
I have the e-card reader, and I have some cards that have been opened and some that are still unopened. I remember it seemed like you would have to scan like a dozen cards even just to assemble a fully completed game like Excitebike. But then the game disappeared the moment you turned your system off, and you'd have to rescan all the cards again. So it was never that practical.
That was the main use for it, was for like playing these classic games. And yeah, they did take like, a whole pack of cards. You had to scan like, 8 cards or something like that. And you could play this this old classic game this way. It was not great or easy to use. I don't know if it was quite that bad with Super Mario Brothers 3. Like I said, I've never actually done it. Presumably, though, all that content was in the game. These were just, keys to unlock that content.
I may have some of those Super Mario Brothers 3 cards. I'll have to go check. But I, for the longest, well, right after I saw, this recent news here, it felt like I'd never even known that this was a thing, that there were these kind of missing Super Mario Brothers 3 levels that I hadn't played. But the more I thought about it, I kind of do remember something like that, but I still don't think I've actually played them. So even if I were to dig them out with my e-card reader, I think this would be a much more convenient way to play them, is to just download this full package on Virtual Console.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's super inconvenient to try to do it the old way. But it's awesome that there's now this way to play what could have sort of been, lost Mario content, disappeared with no way to play it. But no, it is back. It's unlocked, and it's ready to go if you get that game off the eShop. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, as if you needed another reason to buy, one of the best games ever made, Super Mario Brothers 3.
I suppose I should also mention that Zack and Wiki, The Quest for Barbaro's Treasure, which was a Wii game, became available in the eShop last week as well. And I just bring it up because, third-party games did not do so well on Wii, but I think that's one of the best. That's probably one of the top 5, definitely one of the top 10 third-party Wii games. So if you never played it, I definitely suggest checking it out.
Well, I mean, I think what you mean is more kind of a core gamer-focused third-party games, weren't necessarily always big hits on Wii, but obviously Wii was dominated with like stuff like Just Dance, that kind of stuff. But for people that really wanted, and I wouldn't call Zack and Wiki a traditional game experience, but something that really appealed to more traditional gamers, this was one of the few standout titles that unfortunately never really caught on.
It was greatly overlooked, and it could have become a series, a franchise, could have done with a sequel, but nope, it never happened. But yeah, it's got a second chance.
It's a great kind of strategic, almost puzzle-type game, but with some, action-adventure elements, I guess you'd say. It's tough to describe, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the whole point of it was that it uses the Wii Remote in a variety of ways to mimic all these tools that your main characters have. And, it just works really darn well. And it's all, adventure-y, puzzle-solving type things and, fairly small levels. It's not like a full-blown, Telltale adventure game. It's broken down into these bite-sized levels and chunks. And it does focus heavily on, moving the Wii Remote back and forth like a saw to mimic a sawing motion or, shaking it to mimic ringing a bell. It's just really cool. It's fun. It's got another chance.
Yeah, it's great to see, it get some more attention because, like we said, not nearly enough people noticed it when it came out the first time.
And speaking of games getting second chances, or third or fourth or fifth or sixth chances maybe, Sega has recently announced that Sega 3D Classics Collection is coming to the Nintendo 3DS on April 26th. And these are repackaged versions of old games, most of which were released as downloadable titles in the eShop for the Nintendo 3DS. This includes Sonic the Hedgehog, Altered Beast, Galaxy Force 2, Thunderblade, and Fantasy Zone 2W. Plus, there are two new 3DS enhanced games that were not released through the eShop. Those being Puyo Puyo 2 and the racing game Power Drift. And then there are two bonus Sega Master System games, Fantasy Zone 2, The Tears of Opa Opa, which is probably the greatest game title ever made.
Yep.
And Maze Walker.
Was Maze Walker? I'm thinking of 3D Maze Runner. I was going to say, wasn't that one of the 3D games? But I think it wasn't. Because the Master System actually had a pair of 3D glasses you could plug in.
Yeah, I think that this might have been a game that originally used 3D glasses, now that you mention it.
Oh, you know what? I'm getting two 3D games confused. I think there is a 3D Maze Runner that may have been on the NES that was kind of like a Space Harrier game.
That's 3D World Runner.
Okay. Well, I really have gotten some things confused. Yeah, 3D World Runner.
And developed by Square.
Really? Oh, wow. Square of the old, the old Rad Racer era Square.
Mm-hmm. Another 3D game, yep.
Yeah. All right. Well, mazes and running and worlds all have something to do with 3D. Memory is getting worse as the podcast goes on.
But it's coming all in one convenient physical cartridge to plug into your Nintendo 3DS. If you haven't bought them before, or maybe you have and you want to get all the extras, or you just want to have it in physical form, that's going to be your chance in a couple of months. It's kind of strange, really, because there were actually two collections in Japan, and this was the second of those two collections. The first collection contained Shinobi 3, Streets of Rage, Ico the Dolphin, Outrun, and Space Harrier. Those are some pretty significant titles, and it looks like we're not going to be getting those in physical form here. I mean, we already can get them through the eShop, so I guess that's fine, but it's kind of a shame that we're not going to get that like Japan did.
Yeah, I would have been happy to pay a little bit more to have the full package, to just have it all in one collection. But even so, I'm interested in this. Now, you're always telling me every other podcast you bring up these Sega 3D classics, and and I remember these games fondly from my childhood, especially playing a lot of these in the arcade. So I have had some interest, but I guess not enough to really buy it on in a big way. But having them all in one collection has definitely piqued my interest finally, and I might finally jump on board with it.
Well, unfortunately, two of my favorites are Shinobi 3 and Streets of Rage, and they are not in this collection. But still, I think there's a lot to enjoy here. Thunderblade works really well in 3D. Sonic the Hedgehog is an all-time classic. I'm probably going to buy this, even though I have most of it in eShop form already.
Now, this is kind of a newbie question. I should know this, but when you're talking about titles like Altered Beast and Thunderblade, are these 3D kind of ports of the original arcade games? Or are we talking the Genesis games?
It actually varies depending on what the game is. Some of them are straight up arcade games. Some of them are the Master System versions. I believe in the case of Altered Beast, it is the Genesis version. But with Thunderblade, it's the arcade game.
Well, that's good, because the home versions of Thunderblade really couldn't keep up technically. They weren't nearly as good.
Yeah, Sega really did do a fantastic job when they were choosing what titles to port and choosing the correct versions. And they were really fun, you know, just as standalone eShop games. And, you know, I think this this collection will be a nice way for a lot of people to experience them again or perhaps for the first time. So, yeah, I'm happy to see this.
Mm-hmm. Sega.
Woo. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about one of the year's biggest topics, the Nintendo NX. And once again, the rumors are flying hot and heavy this week. This time it comes in the form of a couple of surveys that went out to people. And this first survey, we're not really sure how official it is. We're not sure who commissioned it. We're not sure who it came from. It might have come from a firm that Nintendo actually uses to conduct customer surveys from time to time, but we don't know if they really did so this time. But, you know, and even if they did, that doesn't mean that some of the information contained in the survey is true, because in the course of the survey, it drops a lot of information about the NX. But, you know, they aren't saying, you know, these are definitely things that are going to be there, or this is how the final product is going to be. But there were some interesting details to, you know, learn from this if, and it's a very big if it's real.
Well, it's at the same time, you can't imagine why any, you know, legit, you know, a survey service would just send out, you know, a lot of this stuff randomly. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine Nintendo would have backed this, you know, officially, you know, or you know, potentially revealed any information this way. They're just too secretive to do that. And I don't know what benefit there would really be in them. But, you know, it's making the rounds, and it's interesting to discuss, and there's a lot of interesting stuff in it. So, you know, but just take it with a huge pound of salt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the stuff that it said were things that are really obvious. You know, it'll have exclusive game franchises featuring Mario, Zelda, Donkey Kong, and more. Connect with other Nintendo players around the world via the Nintendo Network. It says gameplay flows between Nintendo NX console and Nintendo NX handheld device, which, you know, that rumor, we've heard that before, and we have, you know, long assumed that that is how the thing is going to work, whether they're sold together or sold separately.
That's right. I was going to say, we've heard variations on it. You know, some of the early speculation claimed that you would just have one device that you would, you know, get home and plug into your TV or take with you on the go. But more recently, people seem to be thinking more along the lines of two separate devices that just share services and maybe some software. And that mm-hmm. seems to be what this survey would potentially be referencing.
I mean, I'm not crazy, am I? When I think that, you know, once upon a time, I think it was Iwata who said that NX was more of a platform than necessarily a console. Didn't he say that, or someone from Nintendo did?
That sounds familiar. I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe I'm mixing it up with him talking about My Nintendo or Nintendo account being more of a platform. But I mean, there's been a lot of things that have come out, especially in some of these investor Q&As over the past year and a half, that have definitely painted a picture that lines up with these types of rumors, that you know, that it is more about you know, the one user account and then taking a lot of that content or some shared experiences, at least between multiple devices, which also includes, and they've said this officially, a lot of these experiences will somehow be connected to, you know, your mobile Nintendo apps in addition to your mm-hmm. handhelds and your home consoles. And you know, even going so far as to say that there'll be tie-ins at other Nintendo-branded events or theme parks, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of the other interesting information, quote-unquote, out of the survey was that it will support 4K 60 frames per second video streaming. So that'd be, you know, smart and cool if they had something like that just built in there. Kind of says that sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if 4K, that would be quite forward-thinking of Nintendo if that were the case.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine that's something worth really building your system to do, unless because of the things your system already does, 4K is just easy, so why not make it 4K?
Well, but
4K, you know, TV adoption certainly isn't to the point yet, and we don't have enough programming where I can't imagine that that's a real, you know, a real benefit.
Well, here's the weird thing, is that it says that the gameplay graphics are only going to be 900p at 60 frames per second, which, of course, is, you know, lower res than what the Wii U can do.
Well, I find it interesting that they would specify a standard, you know, those numbers as any kind of standard at all, because we see on every console that it fluctuates. You know, some games are 60 frames per second, some are 30 frames per second, some mm-hmm. kind of, you know, aren't locked and kind of, you know, fluctuate.
I'm assuming this would be the max specs or something.
Yeah, but like you said, I mean, you can play a 1080p game on Wii U right now.
Mm-hmm.
So why would there be that kind of downgrade? That, you know, doesn't make any sense unless...
Also, why would there be such a huge difference between, you know, the streaming and, the gameplay graphics? That seems odd.
Unless these numbers specifically refer to the handheld component. You know, maybe 900p is just matches exactly what the screen on the handheld device is.
Maybe, but then it goes on to sort of indicate that they're talking about the console version, because it says that what is in the box would be the Nintendo NX console, a sensor bar, a game controller, and an HDMI cable. Apparently it doesn't come with a power cable. You're just going to have to find one of those yourself.
Oh, well... Maybe that's true, because as we know, with the new 3DS, they just expected you to have one already.
Yeah. So I guess what we are saying is a lot of this just doesn't make any sense and doesn't quite add up, and that's one of the reasons it sounds so questionable.
So what's even the point of the survey? Just to say, like, hey, would you be cool with these things? I mean, you have any
part
idea?
Of it. I mean, I saw a bunch of the questions several days ago, but I was looking around online today and I couldn't find them. They seem to have been taken down from the places where I saw them. But they were asking various things, like they were comparing it. Oh, you know, how would you compare, this possible feature of the NX with features of PlayStation and Xbox? Like they were talking about, you know, their online premium services. This is what you get. For free, this is what you pay for. And like one of the things they were saying with NX is, you know, how would you feel about a subscription-based game service that gives you access to like 150 games? You'll probably be games that have already been out for like maybe a year or so. So it wouldn't be like all the brand new titles, but, you know, would you have interest in a survey that's, you know, like this? And then I asked, you know, I think some other questions, doing similar comparisons. That's the only one that really, stood out to me that I can remember right now, unfortunately.
I wonder if those 150 titles might just be virtual console titles.
Yeah, it could be. Very well could be. But said that they would, change, on a regular basis. That was the kind of thing it was asking about. And, who knows? Who knows?
Well, like we say, who knows if any of these, this survey or, you know, any of this speculation has merit. But it does, the more you talk about crazy rumors like this, the more it reminds you of things that kind of have been hinted at or mm-hmm. officially announced from Nintendo. And it really, you know, it always kind of gets your brain going, because I really get the sense that Nintendo's going to do something special with the NX. I think it's going to be more successful than the Wii U. And I think they've just learned so much, and they seem so much more willing to try things. Now, we've seen a lot of experimentation over the last, couple of years. You even think about what they've done with DLC and Amiibo, which are kind of commonplace now, were actually big experiments that turned out to be wildly successful. So I feel like they've been building some momentum, and I just can't wait to see, how the NX story develops throughout the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we might not have to wait too long to find out. We are expecting it at E3, of course. But there was also a GameStop survey asking about, what you might purchase this year. And included on that survey was the NX. So, going by what they're saying, they expect that the system will be out this year. Who knows if that's true? Who knows if they're guessing? Who knows if they're basing that on hard facts? But, they are, adding a little fuel to the fire there themselves.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. If the NX is going to come out this year, and we've heard some rumors, I think we talked about on this show, that maybe you don't get both the console version and the handheld version, if indeed they are two different components. Maybe you don't get those both this year, but maybe you get one of them in time mm-hmm. for the holidays and the other one early next year. In any case, if any part of NX launches this year, do you think E3 is too late to be giving, first official... word on this system, or do you think that's fine?
Not really. I think it would be fine. I mean, that's kind of what happened with PlayStation 4 and Xbox One a few years ago. They had sort of the official unveiling just slightly before E3. E3 was really the big coming out for the systems, and then they hit around Christmas time, and things have worked out pretty well for them, especially for the PS4.
Yeah, but you make a good point about how they did it. They did specifically have those kind of pre-E3 announcement specials to the point where it was almost like, you know, streaming. Well, it was like streaming TV shows, and where they gave certain key information initially, and then E3, they really followed up with more of the software picture and some other key feature announcements. It also gave them the opportunity pre-E3 to potentially float out some stuff that wouldn't be altogether good news. You know, in the case of Microsoft, I think they released some of that early information about, you know, all the weird, you know, it has to be hooked up to the internet all the time and you can't trade with your friends, that kind of stuff. I can't remember specifically what features they talked about pre-E3, but I think there was some of that floating out there. So you could kind of, you know, put some of that out early, let people kind of, you know, maybe get over it. And then E3 hits and, you know, where E3 is kind of more of a bigger spotlight on it. So you want the reaction there to be largely positive. So I don't know, maybe Nintendo could do a good thing, not necessarily that there are bad, you know, bad news they have to give us before the good news, but maybe you float out some of this stuff, you know, that isn't kind of the sexiest stuff, but is kind of important to know to help us start to form a picture. And then you really complete that picture in a big, bad way when E3 rolls around.
Yeah, I mean, Nintendo's done that themselves as well. You know, they announced the name of the Wii well before they had the real coming out party for it. So people could be like, oh, ha, 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 the system's just a big wiener joke. And we all got that. Actually, no one got the other system, but it certainly helped people get out of their system a little bit.
That's true.
Before the big coming out party.
They also unveiled the Wii Remote before they revealed the console mm-hmm. or showed any games. So yep. They really did kind of space that out. I think that's cool. I mean, as a fan who just enjoys, you know, seeing these big reveals, it's fun to give, you know, to kind of pepper throughout the year some of these announcements so mm-hmm. that you've really got stuff to maintain your interest and keep your excitement level high. You know, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me, and I wouldn't necessarily be bummed if we had to wait all the way until E3 to hear anything, but I think it would be cool if we had maybe at least a Nintendo Direct, you know, a couple of months before the show, just to kind of whet our appetite and kind of set the stage. I think that could be pretty cool.
Yeah, they've never said that we have to wait till E3. It very well could happen beforehand, and if it does, sure, that's great.
Yep.
And speaking of wild and crazy Nintendo rumors, there has been a rumor buzzing around all weekend that there is going to be a new Paper Mario game announced in the very near future.
And right, and that wouldn't be very surprising, but it would be a little bit surprising to have a new Paper Mario game coming out kind of right on the heels of this new Mario and RPG, you know, Paper Mario a mashup game that just released.
I guess. I mean, the rumor is that this one is going to be for Wii U, so it wouldn't be on the handheld. But yeah, I did kind of think that the Paper Jam was going to be, okay, well, that's all the Paper Mario we're doing for now. We'll just put in here with Mario and Luigi, and that'll be that. But if this rumor is true, no, there is more Paper Mario on the way.
More Paper Mario is only a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, now it is time to shift to our favorite topic, Amiibo.
Amiibo!
So there were a bunch of Amiibo just released in stores the other day. We got the second wave of Animal Crossing characters, Kix, Celeste, Blathers, and Mr. Rossetti. And then we got Lucas from Mother 3 and Smash Brothers. Did you happen to pick these up, Mr. Slate?
Absolutely. And it was nice to finally be able to add Lucas to my collection so I could stop confusing him with Ness and misremembering whether or not I had either of them.
Excellent. Yeah, I picked up all of the Animal Crossing ones. I imported Lucas a few weeks ago, since I was a little paranoid that he would be hard to find here, just like Ness was. That turned out not to be the case, though. I went out over the weekend, was able to find him at several different stores. Lucas was readily available. All the Animal Crossing ones were available. I guess that's good. Don't want to, you know, see, you know, those, you know, people unable to get the Amiibo like it had been. So I feel like, you know, things continuing to improve.
Mm-hmm.
Out of this batch, do you have any favorites?
Well, I got to be honest, the Animal Crossing characters are all very cute, just like all the other ones. So I really like them as Amiibo. But none of them just happen to be any of my favorite characters. So I guess I would say Lucas, although he's not necessarily you know, if I compare him to all of the Amiibo that have come out already, he's not necessarily a standout for me. One thing that I thought was interesting about kind of this wave, though, was that Lucas and the Animal Crossing Amiibo were all very small. They didn't have any, you know, big or maybe even medium-sized Amiibo. in this set. Mm-hmm. So when I got them all out and kind of looked at them all, it was a bunch of tiny little characters, but they're all very cute and you know, they're all great additions to the collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say that Lucas is my favorite as well, out of those five. But just talking about the Animal Crossing ones, I think I would have to give it up for Kix. You know, I like his funny hat, and it looks like he's gonna go out on a detective adventure with the great Detective Pikachu, maybe.
Yeah, he's kind of a cool looking character. He's a little shifty looking.
He is. That's what I like about him. And he's got a different color scheme that that makes him stand out from the other Animal Crossing characters we've already got. So yeah, I'm gonna give the nod to Kix. But the Amiibo fun is not over yet. Some pre-orders went up for new products. The pre-order for Roy, who is a GameStop exclusive, happened a couple days ago. So if you want to get your hands on him, you can put in a pre-order either online or in the store and ensure that you get that character.
Should be a good one. I like that model.
He's looking a little dated to me compared to some of the other Fire Emblem characters. But, of course, I jumped on the pre-order right away. I'll definitely be getting him. Pre-orders also went up for the third wave of Animal Crossing Amiibo cards, as well as the third wave of Animal Crossing Amiibo, those being Rover and Cap'n. And Tommy and Timmy is in that wave also, but I think he might be exclusive to somewhere, possibly Target. Yeah, for the most part, you can put in pre-orders for those now, and we'll have to worry about it later. Although, if this wave is any indication, it's probably not necessary. Interestingly enough, Summer Isabelle was announced for Japan and Europe and is going to be coming out around the same time, March 18th or 19th. But has not had an announcement here in the U.S.
So what is the difference with Summer Isabelle? Is it just a different outfit or something?
Yeah, I mean, it's a different amiibo. It's, I mean, the one that we got already in the Animal Crossing Amiibo Festival was the Winter Isabelle, and this is, the summer one. Just a different pose, different outfit. Just like we've got multiple Mario amiibos, there will now be two Isabelle amiibos. But you might recall there actually were Summer and Winter Isabelle mystery mushroom costumes in Mario Maker.
Right.
So
yeah.
You kind of know what she looks like based on that.
I guess that's true. They'll announce that for the U.S. for sure, right? I mean,
I'm sure they will. I mean, we know that there are four waves of Animal Crossing cards, and so far three waves have been announced, and each time they've had Animal Crossing amiibo to go with them. So presumably when wave four of the amiibo cards comes out, we'll probably get a few more Animal Crossing amiibo, and probably among those Summer Isabelle. But or maybe Summer Isabelle will come out on their own. Maybe it's a retailer exclusive and they don't want to talk about that yet or something like that. But yeah. I mean, so far everything that's come out in other territories has come out here, so I have no reason to think that it's not going to. But if you're impatient, you can import from Japan or import from Europe or something like that.
Maybe we'll see her in the summer.
Perhaps so. Perhaps that's what they're waiting for. I should also mention that Digby is going to be getting a standalone release on March 18th as well. So if for some reason you really want that character but didn't want to buy the fairly crappy Amiibo Festival game, now you'll have your chance. And just one other thing, while I'm talking about pre-orders and stuff, is that pre-orders also went up recently for Bravely Second, Bravely Second Endlayer Collector's Edition. They went up on Amazon a few days ago and sold out like in minutes. It was ridiculous. But they also went up on GameStop, and they might even still be available. So if you're interested in that, hurry up, jump on it, check it out while you still can.
A lot of cool collector's editions coming out these days. Great to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that takes care of the news for today. We will take an intermission, and when we get back, we'll talk about our favorite Japanese Nintendo developers. All right, we are back, and this time we are talking about our favorite Japanese Nintendo developers. And by that, I don't mean development teams. I just mean some of our favorite gaming creators, the personalities, the individuals that are behind the teams that make these great games.
Yeah, and it just so happens that pretty much everybody who's associated with you know, Nintendo's most classic franchises, you know, does work out of Japan. So naturally, that's what we're focusing on.
Mm-hmm. And of course, if you're going to have this topic of conversation, you can't do it without mentioning Shigeru Miyamoto. He is obviously the godfather of gaming as we know it. You know, he is responsible for, you know, our favorite franchises, for Mario, for The Legend of Zelda, for Donkey Kong, for Pikmin, and he's been involved in almost everything else that Nintendo has done. You know, he's got a fantastic attention to detail. You know, he looks at the aspects of the games that other people might overlook. And, you know, obviously gaming would kind of, you know, be nowhere close to where it is without him. So, you know, clearly he is, you know, one of the all-time greats.
You can legitimately look at Shigeru Miyamoto and think, if it wasn't for his games, would gaming even be here today? Or, you know, mm-hmm. most likely it would be in some form. But people don't remember that, you know, people who just grew up with games don't remember maybe that back after the Atari 2600 crashed, that whole industry kind of disappeared almost overnight. And retailers were really burned by that. They had a lot of games left over. And, you know, for months, you know, you would go into like even a drugstore and they would have a table out that just had $5 Atari games in it, just trying mm-hmm. to, you know, offload all that inventory, to the point where when Nintendo launched in the US, even, you know, though they'd had some success in Japan already, with the Famicom version of the NES, retailers didn't want to do it. And Nintendo executives had to stock the shelves themselves in, you know, test market locations and prove that, that you know, this was a good product and people still wanted video games. So, but, you know, back to my original point, would Nintendo have been able to prove that if they didn't have Super Mario Brothers, you know, with the NES? Because it wasn't, you know, Slalom or, you know, Wild Gunman that was making those things fly off the shelves early on. It was Super Mario Brothers. And mm-hmm. then you think about Donkey Kong in the arcade. And so, yeah, you can't really overstate just, you know, how big of an impact this guy has had. And you also just, I really appreciate, as someone who likes to think of himself as being a little bit creative, I really appreciate the type of creativity that Miyamoto brings, how he really tries as best he can to not limit himself. And how people famously say that when he talks about game design, he basically shows that, you know, when he was thinking of how to make Super Mario Brothers, he starts with kind of a line on a whiteboard, which is just a surface, and then kind of, you know, the arc, you know, arrows showing the arcs of the jump. And everything else, you know, the small little story trappings the game had, you know, what the individual characters looked like, and even the name of Mario, you know, all just came later. It was always in service to the gameplay, and that's kind of been his biggest kind of mantra at Nintendo. One of the biggest things you can say about Nintendo games because of his impact is, unlike, you know, other publishers where, you know, you might have a game that focuses much more heavily on story or is kind of chasing a current trend, with Nintendo, it's all about what's the original idea and then how does you organically build something around that. So I feel like he's always made games in the most kind of purest, you know, creative way you could possibly approach it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I think that's all very true. No way to argue with any of that. And yeah, its importance can't really be overstated. But I was wondering, have you ever had a chance to meet Miyamoto?
Yeah, a few times. Never as long as I would like. It was funny, the first time I went to CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, this is back before they had E3. And
yeah, this was a long time ago, back when CES was the big game show.
Right, because they had, you know, there was no E3. In fact, E3 spun out of CES because they felt like the video game industry got too big to be contained in a general Consumer Electronics Show. But mm-hmm. back then, you know, I finally got to go back when I was with Game Players Magazine. And I believe it was my first time there. I bumped into Mr. Miyamoto.
Like, literally?
Almost. My friend and I, a coworker, were walking across the show floor, and my friend Jeff, he comes across this guy, and they do that thing where, you know, one guy, they're going to run into each other, so one guy moves one way, but the other guy moves the same way. They do a little dance back and forth until they can finally move around each other, and mm-hmm. we get past them, and I'm just like, Jeff, that was Shigeru Miyamoto. So that was my first, you know, run-in almost literally with the man. And then the first time I really met the man was when I went to Japan for the first time. And this was to go to the Shishinkai show where Nintendo unveiled the N64 for the first time. And of course, since they were showing the N64 for the first time, they showed Mario 64 for the first time. So it was one of the most memorable video game anythings that I've ever been a part of, was to, you know, it was my first trip out of the country to Japan of all places. And then, but I missed the first day actually. So I didn't actually get to see the game or the system. And so I take the bus straight from the airport, like hours and hours into Tokyo.
And then you found out that Miyamoto was actually your bus driver.
And he turned around and he said, "And the bus is the N64. And my mind was blown. No,
wow.
But so it took me straight to the kind of the post first day party that they were holding at like this hotel suite. And I met a bunch of other Western journalists there and was just like, couldn't believe that I'd actually managed to, in a land where I didn't speak the language, actually get from point A to point B safely. And so, my first experience is going to Japan by myself, finally making it to this place. They put a drink in my hand and Miyamoto walks up to talk to us about what we thought of everything we saw. And of course, I hadn't seen everything, but it was just a lot of like me just smiling really probably creepily big and just kind of nodding my head and just thinking the whole time, oh my God, I'm looking at the man who made Super Mario Brothers, the man that made me a gamer. And that was pretty amazing. So in more recent years, when we were at Nintendo Power, I got to interview him briefly a couple of times. I even got him during an event for Wii Fit to sign my copy of Super Mario Brothers, the exact same cartridge that like I said, kind of turned me into a hardcore gamer. So that was really special. And every time I met him, he's very gracious. He's always great with journalists and always just seems to really love what he does.
Yep, very open, very humble.
Mm-hmm.
And always proving that attention to detail, no matter what you ask him.
How about you? Did you get to meet him?
Yeah, I've had a few opportunities to interview him about various things. Probably the last time was a couple of years ago at E3. But my interaction with him that stands out the most to me was probably at E3 2007, which is known for being like one of the crappiest E3s. That was the one that they had in Santa Monica, and it was on the beach. And it was spread out all over the place. Yeah, it wasn't in the convention center, which is kind of gnarly. But I was actually still part of Nintendo at that time. And after the first day of the show, they threw a little reception somewhere. I'm at this reception just hanging out. They got a bunch of tables with food. And, so I'm sitting there and I'm snacking on some cheese and I just look over to the side and, hey, look, there's Shigeru Miyamoto also snacking on cheese. And I'm just sort of like hanging out with Miyamoto eating cheese.
And you look over him and you're like, cheese, huh? And he's like, so does.
I don't think that happened. I don't think we engage in much conversation since I do not really know any Japanese. I'm sure I said hi, but there were other Nintendo folks there who could translate, and I remember him making mention of how he really enjoyed being there, and he liked seeing all of the ladies out on the beach at Santa Monica. That is my outstanding memory of meeting Miyamoto in person. Another fantastic Nintendo developer that I would count among my favorites would be Mr. Inuma, Eiji Inuma of The Legend of Zelda fame. And, obviously he's in charge of one of my favorite franchises. And, I just, know that he is working really, really, really hard as we speak to try to make sure that, the next Zelda game and all Zelda games live up to the high expectations that that people have for them. And he's always trying to get inside those games and trying to figure out what made them successful to begin with, what made them tick, and how to build upon that and always make it better. And I have a lot of respect for that.
He's such an interesting creator because this is a guy that for as long as most fans have known who he was, he's worked only on the Zelda franchise. Now, of course, that's covered a lot of games and in some cases, some very different types of Zelda offshoots, like Crossbow Training or, you know, the more recently released Triforce Heroes, or even overseeing projects like Hyrule Warriors. But yeah, to be such a guy who's responsible or been involved with some of the highest rated games of all time, and has really been the, along with Shigeru Miyamoto, kind of the captain of one of gaming's most beloved franchises for a long, long, long time now, it is strange to think that that's all he works on is Zelda titles. But yet he still manages to be creative and bring new ideas to the mix. And it really, when he talks about, you know, with the upcoming game, and he even talked a little bit about this with A Link Between Worlds, challenging the conventions of Zelda games, it really makes you think that here's a guy who's maybe, you know, kind of longing to break out of some of these patterns that he's been, you know, working in for such a long time.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you aware that he actually was not a big fan of the original Legend of Zelda?
No, I don't think I was.
Yeah, when that first came out and he first played it, he appreciated the game, of course, but he just thought it was just too darn hard.
Ah, well, you and he have that in common, maybe for different reasons, but I remember you weren't a big fan of the series until Zelda 2.
It was more the overhead perspective that kind of, you know, got me a little disinterested. I felt the top-down games, you know, for some reason had a bad reputation with me at the time, so that is true. And I got into it with Zelda 2. Anuma really got into it with A Link to the Past. And, I mean, while I really loved Zelda 2, A Link to the Past was also the one that made me into, like, a franchise fan for life. So we also, you know, share that in common. I greatly understand why that happened and why that worked for him as well as for myself. It was such a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm. And then was it his first Zelda title that he worked on, Ocarina of Time? I think he was.
I believe that is the case.
I think he was a director in charge of dungeons in that game, if I remember right.
That sounds right to me. I do believe that is definitely the first one he was involved with personally, though, professionally, I should say.
And in some ways, he's spent the rest of his career since then trying to match the quality and the kind of fan love for that game with every game that's come out since.
Mm-hmm. To finish off the story, though, about you know, he found the original game to be too hard. You know, he didn't think that of Link to the Past. Obviously, you know, that was spot on for him. And then he went on and became a great Zelda creator and made all these fantastic games. But then, you know, Virtual Console rolled around. It's like, oh, here's a chance to go back and play The Legend of Zelda. And, you know, maybe this time I can clear it. And so he went into it again. He's like, man, this is still too hard.
Well, I remember Miyamoto kind of...
they don't make them like they used to.
And I didn't hear this until years and years later after I'd played and beaten the game, but Miyamoto made that game intentionally so that you'd have to work with other people to figure things out. You know, this was way before the internet, so you couldn't just pop on and read a fact, but his intention was that you'd get together with your friends or your classmates, and you'd each trade little bits of information, and together you'd kind of solve all of the puzzles in that game. So, yeah, if you just tackle it by yourself and you're not going to use a fact these days... it is quite a challenging game.
Well, some of the other levels, though, are just really hard from an action perspective. You know, you can take a ton of damage and just get wiped out really fast.
Yeah, that's true.
And then if you continue, you only got 3 hearts, and that's not going to get you very far. So he's not wrong. He is not wrong. It can be pretty challenging.
That is true. Of course, back in on the NES and in those days in general, games across the board were a lot more challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about Zelda 2 aplenty, and you know, I died a zillion times on that, but I got to the point where I was pretty good at it, mm-hmm. and you know, it never seemed that hard to me, but I guess it's because I just kept practicing and practicing. Mm-hmm. But enough of that. Back to our favorite creators. Who else is on your list as one of your all-time faves?
Well, this is a guy that isn't... I would say this is my favorite game developer that is outside of Nintendo, and that's Hideo Kojima.
Yes, I would have to agree with you wholeheartedly. I mean, he's done plenty of stuff, you know, on Nintendo. You know, the original, you know, Metal Gear on NES was, you know, his concept. And of course, we got Twin Snakes, and then all of the, you know, Boktai and Lunar Knights. Those were all his projects. So he has, you know, had a good presence, but yeah, he's also known for lots of stuff on other systems as well, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I really fell in love with the original Metal Gear on the NES, although that was kind of a more limited port of the original MSX title that Kojima worked on. He's not even particularly fond of the NES version. Yeah. But, you know, that
he's gone on record saying that the NES version is kind of crap.
Yeah,
because you don't even fight the Metal Gear at the end.
Yeah, but when it's the only Metal Gear you have, it's still pretty awesome.
We didn't know any better.
Yeah, and I loved it, and so, you know, I've really followed everything that he's done.
Despite these limitations, it's obvious, you know, what the original intent was, and it really came through in that game. So that's just how much of a great creator he was, I would say.
And this is a guy who kind of helped define the cinematic kind of interactive experience.
Very true.
And, you know, he's a bit of a controversial figure sometimes. I think in general, people respect him as a game developer, but some people, you know, he has an absurd amount of ambition. And sometimes he stretches himself a little bit too thin. And, you know, you get maybe like an hour long cinematic or a plot point that's particularly hard to kind of puzzle out. But but more often than not, he really goes the extra mile and delivers something special.
Yeah, I just really love these worlds he creates. The one that really you know, got my attention was a Snatcher on the Sega CD, which just you know, was this you know, futuristic sci-fi game set around 2047, and you know, just add all kinds of little story details to really flesh out this world, and make it, you know, super duper believable. Even though what you actually saw was very limited. But in all his games, you can see that kind of effort going out there and just really bring everything to life.
Yeah, he has an insane, just a level of detail, you know, in his projects. And I used to interview him every year alongside with Randy Nelson, who worked with me on PSM, the PlayStation magazine back in the day.
That was way back, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, we were both huge, huge Metal Gear fans, so we really looked forward to the chance to speak with Hideo Kojima every year at E3. And I think he took an especially strong liking to Randy, because Randy always had some really insightful questions for him. And usually Randy and I would interview him together, and we would both try to come up with good questions. But because they got on so well, we had some great interviews and also some great opportunities. We went to Randy and I both went to dinner with Kojima and some other people from Konami, which turned into like a big all night karaoke thing. So that's what.
Now, what did you sing?
I sang Tiny Dancer, I think, from Elton John. So I sang that in front of Hideo Kojima. It's the only time I've ever sang karaoke with people.
Wow,
I'd normally be
that's
too.
The power of Kojima.
I know. And I can't even, I'm sad I can't even remember what Mr. Kojima sang. He sang at least a couple of songs. But he was really cool. The whole night at dinner, we just kind of peppered him with questions. I think he was working on Metal Gear Solid 3 at the time. And we were just asking him all this stuff. And he loved like being able to give us little hints without saying too much. And I think he loved that kind of cat and mouse with us, because we were obviously such fans. And that's something else that I really got from him in our interviews, was just that he really appreciated the people who appreciated his work, and that he loved to interact with us as you know, diehard fans of the series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, back then, you know, I was working on a multi-platform magazine as well, and I got to interview him quite a few times about Metal Gear Solid 2 and Metal Gear Solid 3. But I always wanted to interview him for Nintendo Power as well, and that was, you know, that proved to be one of my greatest challenges at NP, because, you know, I wanted him for the Power Profiles section. And, you know, that wasn't necessarily supposed to be about just the latest and greatest games. Just, you know, here is a great, important figure in our industry, and we want to just interview him. But, you know, he's a very busy guy. And as many times as I told that to Konami, they're like, oh, no, he's too busy. He can't do that. So it wasn't until Metal Gear Solid 3 was coming out on the 3DS that I finally was able to interview him for that and, you know, pick his brain about, you know, Metal Gear and Snatcher and everything else. And that was a lot of fun. But also, before that interview came through, and we were doing a 20th anniversary article on the NES. It was 20th anniversary, right?
Yeah, because we just had the 30th anniversary.
Okay, no, so it would have been 25th.
25th, anniversary, yeah, right? Yeah. I was just thinking of this as you were about to say it, by the way, but you go ahead.
And, you know, even though, you know, he's like super busy and there's, you know, nothing really Nintendo related that he was working on at the time, I was like, you know, I really would love to get, you know, Mr. Kojima's insights on, you know, what his favorite NES game is. And he came through and, you know, wrote a nice little essay about why Super Mario Brothers and Miyamoto as well, you know, were just, you know, some of the most amazing, important things in all of gaming. And I thought that was really great of him to be able to contribute to that.
Yeah, and that actually goes back, because I think one of the ways we were able to approach him for that was because it may have even been during that dinner I mentioned, where I told him that I had this idea that one day I'd like to write a book about the NES and just about the my favorite games. And he told me during that dinner, he said, well, if you ever do that, let me know. I'd love to write the part about Super Mario Brothers. And I think we, you know, as a team, we discussed that and we thought, oh, well, he seemed open to that back then. Maybe we could get him to do this for Nintendo Power, and it worked out.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact circumstances, but there was something beforehand that kind of indicated that he would like to do that. So that was why I reached out, and sure enough, it worked and ended up being one of the favorite things at Nintendo Power that I ever worked on. So that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Now, who else would you say is one of your top developers?
Let's see. Koji Igarashi, the man known as Iga, is definitely one of my favorites.
He's one of the coolest personalities. We'd interview him and he'd be wearing the whip and the hat from Castlevania.
Yeah, he always had fantastic facial hair as well. But yeah, he would... I mean, it's weird because, you know, some of the guys you talk to and they seem like, you know, they're super cool, like almost too cool to be here. But with Iga, you could tell he was like just doing this, you know, for the fans, for the press, for the people he was meeting, and just kind of like putting on this persona just for the day that he was going to dress like a Castlevania character, sort of cosplay it up. And, you know, it's not to say that he wasn't a cool guy, because he is, and, you know, he's a fantastic game creator, but I always felt like that was him going the extra mile to add some fun to the proceedings.
Yeah, yeah, he definitely was
plus,
a fun guy.
You know, he just makes a fantastic, you know, Metroid-style game. You know, he really took that idea and ran with it and, you know, turned, you know, Castlevania into one of my favorite franchises that we knew that year in, year out, he'd be able to, you know, build up these great worlds that were just so much fun to explore. And even we weren't getting a Metroid, a 2D Metroid that often, you know, we could pretty much rely on Iga and Castlevania to fill that niche for us. And, you know, so he's one of my faves because of that. And, of course, I am greatly looking forward to Bloodstained, his next project.
Me too. Backed it.
And then I guess, you know, I kind of want to say Kaiji Inafune. He that we mentioned earlier of Mighty No. 9 fame. But it's really the fact that he was, you know, the steward of Mega Man that, you know, makes me count him as one of my favorites because, you know, he was responsible for that franchise, kept it going for such a long time and, you know, made so many great games out of it. I mean, he became, you know, somewhat controversial since then. Obviously, Mighty No. 9 is one kind of controversy, but also controversial was that he sort of came out saying, you know, the Japanese weren't necessarily doing video games properly. You need to cater to a Western audience. And I don't really agree with that. I mean, I find that when the Japanese creators just make something that's cool and maybe appeals to the Japanese audience, that I tend to like it as well. Because if it's cool, you know, it's cool, you know. That's the way it is. You don't have to appeal to something that's specifically Western, as far as I'm concerned. And I feel like that kind of maybe, you know, takes away some of the magic of, you know, Japanese game development. But putting that aside, you know, the fact that he was involved in all these Mega Man titles... you know, starting with the original when you know, he did the sprite work and some of the art, most of the art, and you know, then went on to become the series producer and, you know, created Zero and all those great characters in the X games, and kept that series going for such a long time. Totally one of my favorites. I interviewed him several times as well. I did a very extensive feature on around Mega Man's 15th anniversary. I think it was late, so it ended up being like the 16th anniversary or something. But my favorite part of that interview actually was not when I talked to him in person. And, you know, the in-person stuff was, you know, was very extensive. But then I realized, oh, I wanted him to give me just a brief comment on each of the different Mega Man versions. And along with that, I wanted to, you know, just see what he thought of the original classic Mega Man artwork.
So, you mean the artwork from the U.S. box?
Yes, the U.S. box with yellow and blue geriatric Mega Man with the pistol.
Poorly drawn geriatric Mega Man.
So I got in touch with my contact at Capcom, and I just emailed him a picture of the box art and said, hey, can you ask him what he thinks of this? And what they told me was that, you know, during all this time I talked to him and during all the rest of the time the interview was going on, you know, he was obviously just answering all in Japanese. And as he was answering these other questions I pitched, you know, over the internet, he was answering in Japanese. But when they showed him the Mega Man U.S. box art, he just like stops and he exclaims in English, bullshit, which is fantastic and the proper response to seeing that art. His further explanation was that if Americans would buy that, they will buy anything.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, I do wish that had been in person, but yeah, it sounds sounds pretty awesome the way that all unfolded.
Well, I'll go ahead.
I do hope that he is able to you know, get his act together and deliver with Mighty No. 9, so I can once again say he is one of my all time favorite creators, and that didn't stop when he stopped doing Mega Man. But yeah, I mean, I've still got the utmost respect for him.
Well, dipping back into Nintendo's development pool for a second, one guy that I unfortunately only ever met very briefly for just one interview at a particular E3 was Masahiro Sakurai.
Yes, Mr. Sakurai.
Mr. Creator of Kirby and creator of the Smash Brothers series. Mm-hmm. I mean, that alone, you just take even one of those franchises, and that alone is enough to kind of get him into the, you know, Game Developer Hall of Fame as far as I'm concerned. But but it seems like everything he does, you know, I'm a huge fan of Kid Icarus Uprising, you know, which, you know, some people fall on the side of being that kind of game. You're either a massive fan or you're not. And usually it's whether or not your hands cramp when you play it.
Yeah, my hands cramped a lot, I'm afraid. I'd love to go back and give it another try, though.
Yeah, but my hands were fine and I really dug that game. And I believe I got to interview him at the E3 where that game was unveiled, if I remember correctly, which would have been when they also unveiled the Nintendo 3DS. Mm. But the only thing I can really remember about it was me trying to ask him a question about Kirby, because they had also, I think, unveiled maybe it was the Kirby game for Wii, like the multiplayer one. And he misinterpreted that, or there was some kind of miscommunication where he thought I was asking him as, you know, where it seemed like I thought he was the developer of that game. And so the answer was just more of a, explaining to me that he had nothing to do with that game. And I was just like, in my mind, I'm just like, no, just don't think I'm an idiot. That's not what I was trying to ask. You're one of my heroes. Please don't think I'm stupid. I mean, he was really cool about it. I didn't want him to think I had my facts wrong. But anyway, you know, it was cool meeting him. And he's just a very kind of, very, you know, kind of mellow, subdued kind of dude.
Well, he seems very serious to me. In fact, I just saw something online talking about his meeting with Square when, you know, they were deciding to put Cloud into the game.
Mm-hmm.
And he was described as being, they thought he was very serious. And that's certainly the impression that I got of him. I think I only met him once as well, and it was to talk about Smash Brothers. And, you know, I remembered seeing, you know, these pictures of, really poseable action figures being posed to, you know, figure out how the character animations were going to work. I'm like, oh, well, that's cool. I'll ask him, you know, maybe he's really into action figures or something, and I can talk to him about that, and I can, you know, get some new, you know, insights on, you know, this great creator that way. And so I ask him about that, and he's just like, nope, I don't care about that stuff.
You know what? I bet that that something must have, you know, something must be kind of held back in the, translation process in an interview like that. Because if you look at his games, it's hard to think of, well, that, you know, the guy behind, you know, the cuteness of Kirby or just the outright silly fan serviceness of Smash Brothers would be an overly serious dude. Even Kid Icarus is like the, you know, it's the probably the biggest attempt Nintendo's ever made at making a pure comedy kind of game. Mm-hmm. So
well, I just think that, you know, he's very much a professional.
Yeah, yeah.
He's you know, so professional and focused on his work that he comes across as serious. I'm sure he does have a fun side as well. Clearly he does, because of all the goofy stuff that's in the games. But I suspect that's why he comes across as so serious, is just because, you know, very focused on making fantastic titles for everyone to play.
Yeah.
Let's say, I don't want to, you know, make this episode go, you know, super duper long, but just to mention a couple other of my favorites. One of them would be Shu Takumi from Capcom, who is responsible for the Ace Attorney and Ghost Trick series. You know, some of the stuff he does is, you know, a little goofy, but I always enjoy his mysteries. I really enjoy his characters. And, my one little, brief story about him that, you know, I tried to get into the Power Profiles interview in Nintendo Power was, we were talking about Ghost Trick. And then of course there are, you know, characters in Ace Attorney that can channel spirits. And so I'm like, well, what would happen if, this character, if, Maya was able to channel, Sissel, the ghost from Ghost Trick, and we're making this, hilarious, gesture with his hand to indicate his spiky hair and how she would suddenly grow spiky hair since she, takes on the, appearance of the people that, she is channeling. But yeah, I, you know, love his stuff. He's a great one. And then, I have to, give a shout out to Yuji Naka, the man who, mostly programmed Sonic the Hedgehog, was one of the co-creators of that long-lived franchise. He helped put the Genesis on the map with that one. So he's certainly a favorite, and he was another one that we got to write about Super Mario Brothers for that 25th anniversary. And I remember on the occasion when I talked to him about that. I went in there and I was like, oh, I want to, ask you some questions for the 25th anniversary of the NES. And man, he totally looked like he wanted to fight me after that.
Really?
Yeah. And the reason for that is because, I think the translator like translated it as like the 25th anniversary of the Famicom. And so it would have been 2 years difference.
Oh.
And so... He was like, wait, like this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm going to have to challenge him. But we got ironed out that I was talking about, the American NES anniversary and not the anniversary of the Famicom. So that got smoothed over very, very quickly.
Although if you had been punched in the face by Yuji Naka, that would have been an even cooler story.
It would. That would have been a lot of fun to be able to talk about. maybe less fun at the time. But it's just cool to see, how serious he is about, classic video games and video game knowledge and lore and stuff like that. And that was... really neat to experience firsthand without any broken noses or blood. anyone else on your list?
Yeah, and this guy is more for just him as a person, actually, than his games, although I have enjoyed several of his games, and that's Tobunobu Itagaki.
The creator of Devil's Third.
Yeah, well, more famous for the Dead or Alive series and Ninja Gaiden, yes. And the work he did back when he was with Tecmo for most of his career. But, as the internet knows, this guy has a crazy kind of, rock and roll personality, which is especially unusual for a Japanese game developer. He's always got the big shades on, kind of the rock and roll look, and it just says like, whatever's on his mind, he don't give a crap, and but in person you couldn't meet a sweeter guy. At least that was my experience with him, and I believe the first time I met him was when I was on PSM magazine again, and we were about to do a cover, Dead or Alive 2 with the PS2 was going to be on the cover of one of the issues that was coming out right around the time as the PS2. So the PS2 still isn't launched yet. And we go to Tecmo's office in Japan, to meet with him and talk about it. And we get there and Itagaki's not there. And not only is he not there, but even the company president has no idea where he is. And as we're waiting to see if Itagaki's going to show up or not, the guy goes on to tell me that, he'll just go into hardcore development mode with his team. And for like days on end, he won't leave the office, he will hardly sleep, won't go out to eat. And then he'll just disappear for like an equal amount of time. And he says even his wife won't know where he is. Like he'll just fall off the face of the earth. And then you just got to wait for him to show up again. And so he did. We didn't have to wait too long, I don't think. And he showed up and... And I played Dead or Alive 2 against him, and of course he really, you know, embarrassed me, made me look terrible. And then we went out to eat at this really fancy Chinese restaurant. I think it may have been in Roppongi Hills or something like that. Mm. And it was like this huge, like multi-course meal. They kept bringing out stuff like, you know, shark fin soup and then a whole other course of this stuff. And, you know, I'm a pretty picky dude. I'm just like, you know, I go to Japan and unfortunately I'm just looking for katsu or McDonald's. So, it was kind of wasted on me and I was trying to pick at it and, you know, not be too obvious with how ungrateful I was seeming, for such an expensive meal. But the cool thing about that is, during that meal, another guy that was with me, a guy named Max, who used to work with us on PSM, he was talking. He was fluent in Japanese, so he was able to
nice.
He was able to talk pretty directly with Itagaki. And Itagaki started talking about you know, his plans for Ninja Gaiden and bringing that series back, which I'm not even sure if that had really been announced at the time.
Oh, wow.
And so we were,
that goes way back.
Yeah. So we were kind of getting some early scoop. And actually at that time he told us one of the ideas he had was this kind of vision of basically a ninja holding on to like the claws of a giant eagle or something and like flying around that way, throwing shuriken at people down on the ground. And my friend Max mentioned the idea of, you know, they were talking about, you know, specifically finding the right tone for the game or something like that. And my friend Max said the phrase dark hero, which Itagaki really locked onto and really liked. And then in subsequent years at E3, I'd always bump into Itagaki. Sometimes if he had a game coming out, we'd interview him. And again, with my friend Randy from PSM, he made great friends with Itagaki. And so we would, I think the year that the GameCube came out, Randy, Itagaki, and I, you know, found a moment where he could sneak away from his booth and we all went over to play GameCube together and kind of see what those
games
were.
That's very cool.
Yeah. He was a huge, I mean, although he never did a ton of work directly for Nintendo consoles, he was a huge Nintendo fan. And that really came out when he went over and played, you know, Luigi's Mansion and every Pikmin and everything that they had there that first year. So that was fun. And he was also prone to just kind of wacky things like in the middle of the show floor, I think he told Randy, you know, I forget how the conversation had gotten to this point, but he said it was probably Ninja Gaiden or one of the Dead or Alive. He says, I promise this is going to be an amazing game. And then he just kind of like holds up his fists in the air and kind of says to the whole show floor, I promise the world. So you got to love that guy.
Excellent.
You know, I really wish Devil's Third had, you know, done better, but man, what an entertaining character.
I still haven't had the chance to play the game. I don't know. It might be brilliant for all I know.
I haven't either. I can't say from personal experience how good it is or isn't, but you know, I wish it had had a better you know, financial success.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, when I was saying earlier, you know, it seems like Iga, you know, specially dresses up to be cool for you know, events when the fans are around. Yeah, Itagaki's like the opposite of that. He's like, you know, he's the cool guy 24/7.
Yeah, yeah. But at the same time,
just,
he's
always in that mode.
At the same time, he's kind of a, you know, he's a game nerd, but yet he's like a rock and roll game nerd. So I don't know. The mix is especially endearing, I think.
Mm-hmm. I guess the last guy that I'd like to give a shout out to is Hironobu Sakaguchi. He is the man responsible for creating the Final Fantasy series. You know, he's no longer with Square. He now has his own studio, Mistwalker. He did make one of my favorite games of the last generation, that being The Last Story. He also did Lost Odyssey over on Xbox, which I quite like. And I have to say, out of, you know, all of the different game developers I've had a chance to meet and interview over the years, you know, he is the one that stands out that I have never had a chance to meet in person. I've done, you know, some email interviews, but you know, I felt like the translation on that wasn't very good, and it just wasn't didn't click the way I wanted it to. So if I had one more person I would get to interview, if Nintendo Power were still around, it would be Mr. Sakaguchi.
I don't have a great story about meeting Mr. Sakaguchi, but I did get to meet him. It was, I think, on a promotional junket for Final Fantasy The Spirits Within, the CG movie that came out way back
then. Yeah, that was one of his, I wouldn't want to say shining moments since it ended up not being so great. But yeah, he was, you know, really in charge of that. He was really pushing for that. And, you know, it kind of, I think that's kind of one of the things that led to Square merging with Enix in some regards, but it was certainly a big deal when that was coming out.
Yeah, that was really his baby, and that was made, I think, out of Square Square's Hollywood, not Hollywood, Honolulu.
Hawaii, right?
Yeah, Honolulu office in Hawaii. And so we all flew down there for a couple of days. It was
That must have been pretty swanky.
It was awesome. It's the only time I've ever been to Hawaii, but it was so much fun, even just like basically in and out in a day and a half, 2 days. But
unfortunately, I'm now having visions of Slate and a Speedo, and I don't really want my brain to go there.
I did not wear a Speedo, but
Slate and Sakaguchi in Speedos gallivanting up and down the beach.
A certain Sony PlayStation executive who also attended the trip did wear a Speedo, and I will not name any names. But it was quite the sight.
Burned into your brain.
Unfortunately, yes. But yeah, I did get to meet Sakaguchi in his office, which is on the very top floor of the square building there, which had an amazing like wraparound view of the ocean. And I just couldn't help but think it was probably like the best office anywhere in the world. And I was there with a bunch of other journalists, and we didn't get to speak to him too long. But he seemed like a fine guy. I just didn't get to, you know, to dig into anything especially interesting. But yeah, I mean, you look at his body of work, the Final Fantasy series, if nothing else, you know, makes him a legend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds pretty awesome. I wish I could have been there. Anyway, yeah, no disrespect to any of the other great developers we didn't mention. There are obviously a lot of them, but if we kept talking about it, this show would go on for an eternity. So I think we're going to wrap it up here. But before we go, there is still time for a dramatic reading, this time from the back of the box of the NES game Shatterhand. No arms on Earth can withstand the power in your hands. Imagine packing the power of 100 strategic missiles in every punch. Imagine needing every single megaton just to hold your own against a cybernetic army of metallic monstrosities. That's the guts of Shatterhand, the game that redefines hand-to-hand combat in the 21st century, along with all the standards for single-player action games for the Nintendo Entertainment System. 7 levels of programmed adventure. You choose the action. State-of-the-art graphics featuring 8 direction scrolling. Anti-gravity levels force you to fight upside down. Armed satellite robots assist you in battle. Game continue feature.
Why is it I remember the box for that being that he's punching at you, and I feel like his own hand is showing signs of shattering?
Yes. It is a dude in shades punching the Shatterhand logo so hard that he is tearing the flesh off of his right hand and showing his robotic hand underneath.
That's not the kind of shatter hand you'd kind of want. That's it for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com, and you can follow us at powerprospod on both Facebook and Twitter. You can follow The Hoff on Twitter at Chris The Hoff, and I'm at Chris Slate. And be sure to check out The Hoff's blog called Still Playing With Power, and you can find it at christhehoff.tumblr.com. And you can email us at powerprospod@gmail.com. And hey, if you like the podcast, we'd love it if you could stop by iTunes and let us know.
Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Chris Slate.
See ya.
And that insufferable know-it-all, Professor Layton.
A true gentleman never refuses the request of a beautiful lady.
We will see you next time.